Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Glad you're with us today. Bill Arnold here in studio. Rebecca Maxwell on the board. Paul Perreault in the newsroom. We've got a great show lined up for you this morning. I want to start with Psalm 27, verse 14. It says, "Wait for the Lord, be strong, and take heart, and wait for the Lord." I love that. A lot of us are waiting on the Lord in a time of our lives where we're wondering what is next. And we just need to stay patient and trust the Lord. There's a great daily devotion from Pastor Tim Keller I would like to read right now. I think you'll enjoy this. One of the main teachings of the Bible is that almost no one grows into greatness or finds God without suffering, without pain coming into our lives like smelling salts to wake us up from all sorts of facts about life and our own hearts to which we were blind. For reasons past our finding out, even Christ did not bring salvation and grace to us apart from infinite suffering on the cross. As he loved us enough to face the sufferings with patience and courage, so we must learn to trust in him enough to do the same. And as his weakness and suffering thus faced led to resurrection power, so can ours. Let's put our trust in the Lord as we get our day started. We've got Karen Ellis coming up in just a moment. So we've got a great start to the show coming up. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and bring on Karen. Good morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. I have on our Skype line Karen Ellis from International Christian Response. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Tell me what your passport is looking like nowadays.
My passport is resting in the corner right now of my dresser. It's taking a break, okay. And so am I.
Tell me where some of the stamps are from.
Most recently, Australia, England, because okay. I was England. I think the last time we spoke, I was in England.
You were studying.
Right. Before that, I was in Australia. I had the opportunity to go and learn from Aboriginal Christian leaders who are doing amazing, difficult work rebuilding the community, the Aboriginal community in Australia, from the inner man out and the inner woman out. So I had a chance to sit and talk and listen with them. We went all over the place. We started out in on the coast in Sydney. We went to the interior. We went to Alice Springs, the Northern Territories, spoke with a number of different ethnic groups there, and was just came away really encouraged. They're doing some very, very hard groundwork there across denominations, building up a people who have really had their identity questioned and damaged, and so they're bringing the Bible to bear on who Christ says they are and what a beautiful and complete and important and valuable people they are to him. So that was the last place I was before I spoke to you in England.
Okay, well, I have to ask, Karen, where do the Aborigine communities live in Australia?
Well, they're all over the population. Okay. Most of the population of Australia actually lives on the coast, 85%.
As would I if I live there.
Right. Yes. Yeah, there's not a lot in the middle, but there are people living in the middle, in the interior, they would call it. And so they're all over the place. Of course, the folks in the middle, in the middle region, they're harder to reach because there's not a lot that supports life out that way, mm-hmm. except for the tourism industry.
Yeah, and Karen, what is the one thing you learned that sort of took you by surprise?
Oh, my word. One thing?
Well, maybe, yeah, as you're learning from these Aborigine community folks.
Right. I think it underscored for me the value of Indigenous leadership.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, any Westerners that we met had... Most Westerners had placed themselves under the leadership of, or we're developing leaders from the indigenous population. And that's really, that is the way to go, you know, to see for when people come up and they've had their identity compromised and damaged by lots of different things, by, you know, other civilizations, by, you know, poor mission efforts throughout history. You know, one of the strongest ways that you can build a people back up is to raise up leaders from inside and then let them lead themselves. Train them well, let them lead themselves, because they know their population, they know their languages. It would take us so long to actually get a toehold and a foothold in understanding the community. And these people are already equipped. And then they're seeing themselves validated in leadership. You know, they're seeing, then people come up and they say, oh, I can be a leader too. So I think one of the most important things I learned was or was underscored for me, which I knew going in already, mm-hmm. was the value of raising up indigenous leadership within populations.
Mm-hmm. These are excellent answers, and that moves you into the next round of questioning. Are you ready?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Did I win anything?
Yes, you did. Not yet. But that moves you into topics Bill knows very little about. That's today's subject. Let's talk about
learning together.
Yes, let's talk about the Rohingyas, and who are they, and who is against them?
Right. Well, first off, Bill, I want to say thank you for bringing this to your show. This topic, it's something that sort of stays on the margins. A lot of people are mildly aware of what's going on, but it's an enormous problem that hasn't been given a great deal of media attention. So we appreciate
been talking about it more than once.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful. But you already know that the major players in this case are the Rohingyas, an ethnic population who's largely Muslim, although there's a very small handful of Christians among them. And then the other actors are the Buddhists in Myanmar. Rohingya Muslims are considered one of the most persecuted ethnic groups on earth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of their leadership in Myanmar has denied reports of human rights abuses by the military. They've told reporters that, they're providing humanitarian aid to people who've been affected by all the violence. But it's actually caused over 400,000 people to leave the region. That's a lot of people. As a matter of fact, a report by the UN Human Rights Office that was released just last week said attacks on the Rohingyas and widespread burning of villages reflect a strategy of instilling widespread fear and trauma to, they don't want them to ever come back. They want them to be so traumatized that they'll never step back in the country.
That brings up the word catastrophe.
Even beyond that, entire villages burned down. I think over 2,600 villages burned. At this point, you can see them. It does. You can see the devastation on satellite images. Mm. And what's even more disturbing is that the leadership denies that this is happening when there's so much evidence to the contrary.
Ignore the fires. This isn't happening. How do they do that?
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And I mean, there's pictures. You know,
there's evidence.
There's people. There's solid, concrete evidence.
Oh, facts don't matter. We all know that.
It's so painful. It's so painful when you're talking about lives. So what's the difference between ethnic cleansing and genocide? A lot of people have been asking me. They kind of overlap. It's a difference between where you're allowed to live on one hand, which is ethnic cleansing. That's what we're seeing with the Rohingyas.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you're allowed to live at all on the other hand, that's genocide. But there is some overlap because they will commit genocidal acts in order to get you to move. So it's ethnic cleansing is like forced deportation, population transfer, whereas genocide is intentional murder. They're going to get rid of you by getting rid of you permanently rather than forcing you to move, right? So, and the UN has called the Rohingya population situation textbook ethnic cleansing.
Mm-hmm. How does the UN define ethnic cleansing?
When you have a purposeful policy that's designed by one ethnic or religious group, in this case, it would be the Buddhists, to remove people by violent and terror-inspiring means, and it's a civilian population of another ethnic religious group from a certain geographic area, then you have what they would call ethnic cleansing. A lot of this got hashed out in the 90s when they were addressing Rwanda and former Yugoslavia. And, you know, it includes coercive practices like murder, torture, arbitrary arrest and detention, executions without trial, rape and sexual assaults, confinement of the population to a ghetto area. You can forcibly remove or displace or deport the civilian population. In this case, with the Buddhists, there's been direct and deliberate military attacks. Clearance operations, which are they're essentially prolonged killing sprees. That's the clearance operation. They can, and then, you know, when you conflict with the Red Cross or the Red Crescent and medical personnel. So these are all things that the International Criminal Court would link to ethnic cleansing, more specifically to genocide. They will call them crimes against humanity and war crimes. But because the International Criminal Court has included ethnic cleansing under international law, you can actually punish these acts. And even though they're still figuring out exactly where the lines are between ethnic cleansing and genocide.
Karen, are the Buddhists against the Rohingyas?
It is largely the Buddhist population.
Who's against them?
Right. You know, Buddhists, we always think of them as, you know, as think of it as a nonviolent worldview, but anybody can be violent, right? It takes a regenerated heart to be consistently nonviolent,
Thank you for that profound statement.
The principles of Buddha, they may stress peace, but they don't have power to regenerate or transform a person's heart. Only Christ can do that.
Yes.
His Holy Spirit. So, yeah, the attacks against the Rohingya by security forces and Buddhist mobs, the UN has stated that they are systematic, they're coordinated with the intent of driving them out. What are the dynamics that got us here? This is as old as a garden. First case of oppression.
Karen, let me take a break before we get into that, because we do have to take a break, and that will move us into the final round of questioning, because you've certainly gotten to that point, which is very exciting for me. It's 17 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Karen Ellis from International Christian Response. We'll be back in just a minute. Good and morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Karen Ellis from International Christian Response, and we're trying to figure out some of the activity with the Rohingyas and who's against them. And it sounds like the Buddhists are in opposition, but they're kind of supposed to be nonviolent people. But Karen, you say, of course, and I believe completely, without the restraining power of the Holy Spirit, violence and evil comes through anybody.
It's true. It's true. You have to have a regenerated heart. And, you know, it's not just the Buddhists, though. This has been going on for a number of decades between the Rohingyas, the Buddhists, and another major actor is the Myanmar government. So the Rohingyas have lived for centuries in the West, in Myanmar. They've been persecuted by the Myanmar government for a long time. They are not even ranked or considered among the country's 135 official ethnic groups, which basically says to a person, you don't exist. We're not going to acknowledge you.
Yeah.
And you don't exist. So, and they've been denied citizenship since the early 80s. Their state, as a result, is one of the poorest in the country, because if you don't exist, how do you get resources?
Yeah.
You know, how do you get infrastructure? Of course.
Yeah.
So they follow different religions from others. They spoke different languages. They have a whole different culture altogether, and they've always been mistrusted by the other populations. There was a really great New York Times article, very powerful in the stories that it chose to tell of the people who were fleeing the violence. And they mentioned the work of Azim Ibrahim, whose book on the Rohingya explains that a lot of this animosity can be traced back to World War II, when people were trying to figure out who was going to get the spoils from the British government. Now, this isn't a part of partition. Okay, this has nothing to do, the case with the Myanmar has nothing to do with partition and how India was separated after World War II. But in the middle of all of that, along with government issues and government oppression, there was a rise in Buddhist nationalism. And a number of influential Buddhist religious leaders said that the Rohingya were the reincarnation of snakes, insects, vermin. They should be exterminated. Is that language starting to sound familiar?
Yeah, sure is.
Yeah. So this kind of dehumanizing language is really common in an otherization process. You know, people like to make an other. Ever since Cain and Abel, ever since the garden, Satan attacking the first woman and the first man, you know, we've regarded each other as a threat and a problem that has to be dealt with, and in Cain and Abel's case, exterminated, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it starts to sound like the Rwandan genocide, when people were referred to as cockroaches, or when the Jewish population was referred to as vermin, and even when the language of animal husbandry was used to breed American slaves, you know, bucks and studs. You know, when you start to reduce people to animal status, it becomes very easy to abuse them,
mm-hmm.
destroy and kill them, because they're not human. You've reframed them in your mind. And this is our depravity coming through. It's been like this since the garden. Satan has been trying to sabotage harmony between people among human beings. These are the fruits of that. So that's sort of how we got to this point.
Yeah, that is a blind point. Region. Yeah. Usually starts over stuff.
Yeah,
starts
over the
stuff.
Right to exist.
Yes, oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So Karen, tell us why all this matters. This is so significant, but give us your perspective on this.
Well, obviously, international law takes the international community to uncover and prosecute these kinds of abuses.
Mm-hmm.
A number like 400,000 people fleeing violence because they're being forced from their own country, because they are who they are, this isn't collateral damage. This is, you have to leave because you are a certain kind of people. That adds to the millions that are already stressing the populations of refugees and people living in deportation centers around the world. And it is a global problem. Why does it matter to us? Our administration right now has a very unpredictable approach to human rights.
Mm-hmm.
It's chaotic, and that's distressing in a situation like this, particularly as this particular administration lays claim to a Christian worldview. If any worldview has anything to say about the ethnic cleansing of an entire people and about its obfuscation and its cover-up, it's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Widows, orphans, foreigners are the natural products of these kinds of conditions. I actually don't believe we rightly reflect the imago Christi, the image of Christ that believers bear, if we don't acknowledge and protect the image of God among the general population. The numbers of people that are displaced in the world today, they do not lie. They're astronomical. We've never seen anything like this before in history. And when I see leaders being inconsistent about America's international position to weigh in a substantive way, I feel like it distorts what Christianity is and how it's practiced to the world. And it adds another burden. We were talking about indigenous Christians before. It adds another burden for indigenous Christians in other countries to have to constantly counteract what is actually the biblical stance of human rights. So that's why it matters. It matters to our Christian identity. How we handle these things internationally, our position on the global stage. And I'm not saying our position as America's, cowboy riding in with the hat, you know, the white hat on the horse to say, that's not, I'm even talking about just as a voice among other international actors to weigh in on these things is really precious. I want to see it preserved because that's the only way that any of these things, we have to go beyond humanitarian aid and relief to get at the core of some of these issues. So I have great respect for our humanitarian aid leaders, our UN leaders who are actually applying biblical principles to these problems and working with others across ideological and worldview lines. Great respect for them. we need more, and we need a consistent stance on international policy, foreign policy, and how we're going to approach the rest of the world in solving some of these problems.
Mm. Karen, I so appreciate your perspective, and you're going home today with considerable cash and prizes, as well as the home version of the Early Morning Late Show, which you can play with friends and relatives.
Does it have a spinning dial? That's
yes, it
all
does.
I want.
Yes, it
oh,
does.
Great. That's, then my life is complete.
With lots of bright colors. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I just love having you as a guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. We appreciate you. God bless you.
God bless you. It's 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and then lighten up with Ken Davis.
It's morning. Your best bet to make it a good one is to listen to the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
A big thank you to Karen Ellis. She's amazing. I just love her perspective. Always love having her on the show. We're going to take a break for news. And then when we return, odds are real good Dr. Ken Kaiser will be here. So get ready for bagpipe music.
Thanks to your generous ongoing support, God is moving mightily through the programs on Faith Radio. Rob called us and shared his experience.
You have no idea how you are touching hearts with your program and encouraging others, loving others, bringing healing and wisdom and needed understanding to the souls of many. So many of us are deeply thankful to the Lord for how he's using you.
Share your Faith Radio experience by calling the Faith Line at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH.
Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. How about this name? Jeff Scheinebarger. Love that. And he says, all of us must make decisions every day. Jeff helps us understand the different types of decisions we face and how they shape our lives.
There's three kinds of decisions people are wrestling with. The first is just the mundane decisions of every day. These are the easy things, right? These are the, I've been told it's about 5,000 decisions we make on an average day. It's like, what pants are you going to put on in the morning? What are you going to eat for breakfast? What is the directions you're going to go to work? These are easy, mundane decisions. But the hard decisions are the moments of tension and the moments of transition. And these two times, these are the real hard decisions of how to move forward. Moments of tension are usually related to other people are involved, and you're trying to work through a problem to get to a solution in some way. In moments of transition, these are when you're trying to decide if you want to stay in the same job consistently, if you want to buy the house, if you're in a relationship with a girl and you're trying to decide if you want to marry that woman. You know, these are hard transition moments that start to define major movements in your life.
That is Jeff Scheinebarger, and if you want to hear that entire interview, you might want to go to My Faith Radio just for the fun of typing in Scheinebarger, because that could be kind of amusing this morning to get your day started with a big smile. We'll take a short break, and then Ken Kaiser is already here, so you know what that means. Get ready for bagpipes.
It can get ugly out there when biblical values no longer matter. This is Jim Garlow. Even if you don't believe in God's Word, it's hard to argue against the need for values in business, in politics, in any pursuit. America's values have historically been rooted in Christianity and in biblical principles. And as such, we shouldn't be known for ripping people off, lying, stealing, embezzling, etc. And if we do something unethical, we must admit we've sinned. Not a popular word in today's culture. Democracy can't function, not long-term anyway, without biblical values. Values like honesty, integrity, loyalty. Whether America succeeds or fails will depend on the extent to which her leaders embrace biblical, Christian values. It's not necessarily a popular thought, but it's true. Go to jimgarlow.com for more on this.
Twenty-two minutes until the top of the hour. Love that bagpipe music. You know what that means. Ken Kaiser is here in studio. Karen Ellis is one tough act to follow, but if anyone can do it, it's Dr. Ken Kaiser. Communications chair here at the University of Northwestern. Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
So when is bagpipe practice? Is it tonight?
Tonight we have band practice because we have a concert on Saturday, 8 p.m., McAllister College. Come on down.
No. I'm quite busy that night. There's got to be something on TV. Kent, all right, this Supreme Court with Christian Baker, he's now had a request to bake a Satan cake. They're going after this guy, but this could actually backfire.
Well, no, this is actually, I think, helping him.
That's what I mean.
People might recall is that this Christian Baker refused to decorate a cake for a same-sex wedding, and now he's had a request to create a cake for, well, I'll just quote from the article. He received an email that said, "I would like to request a quote on a birthday cake for a special event. It is a cake that is religious in theme, and since religion is a protected class, I am hoping that you will gladly bake this cake. As you see, the birthday cake in question is to celebrate the birthday of Lucifer, also known as Satan, who was born as Satan when he was cast from heaven by God." And so It's an interesting case because I personally think maybe the Christian Baker's own attorneys found somebody to make this request, because as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, this Baker already has this case in front of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has already determined that you can't use religious freedom as a reason to discriminate against people. However, a different part of the First Amendment, which is the freedom of expression, has always been kind of trumped other things. And so the way that this Christian Baker is probably going to win this case, most legal observers are saying, is that he will be able to say that you can't force him to produce a message that's against his conscience. So in the case of the same-sex wedding, it's not a matter of that he won't serve gay couples or something, because he has in fact served gay couples in the past, but they can't ask him to produce a message, or in other words, use his artistry as a cake baker and decorator to promulgate a message that's against his conscience. Well, this... And in the past, he, by the way, also has served atheist clients before. Mm-hmm. And in this case here, he's got this cake he's being requested to make that, again, will have a message, would potentially have a message that would be against his conscience. And so the baker is going to be able to come back with a message that that's against his conscience. So it would be against his First Amendment right to free speech or free expression. And that's probably where he's going to win that Supreme Court case. And this, if he refuses this one, this cake, as he did the same-sex marriage cake, then this only strengthens his case. That's why I kind of think that his own attorneys might be behind having found somebody to ask for this particular cake. I don't know that, but that's just my, you know, cynical me, I guess.
Or whatever. Building their case?
They are.
It makes a little, makes some wisdom there.
I think they are building their case. And again, I think he's going to win this. Although, I mean, I know a lot of us would probably love it if he could win this on the freedom of religion aspect of the First Amendment. But again, the Supreme Court in the past has said that you can't discriminate against people and invoke your religious freedom to do so. But people cannot make you promulgate a message that's against your conscience.
Yeah, and June can't come soon enough for you, can
it? Oh, I cannot wait till the end of June. It's always that last week of June when all those Supreme Court cases are, when all the decisions come out. Oh, yeah. I just look for it every single day. You know, I'm on the Supreme Court website every single day just waiting for things. I'm like a reporter waiting for stuff to come out. I love it.
All right, let's talk about a little bit of the story of the Hollywood depravity, which continues just to be headlines in the news. And as Christians, we're obviously offended by all of it, but let's talk about it.
Well, people have all probably heard of Harvey Weinstein. I mean, last week when I went to see a movie, there was just a preview for a different movie, and Weinstein Productions or whatever came up for like 2 seconds on screen in one of those previews, and there were audible gasps from people in the audience. So people obviously were already well aware of Weinstein and you know, the sexual advances he had made toward actresses and models and so on. And it is just really unfortunate that you have this whole industry where you Well, it's like they're like starving artists. I mean, honestly, we've all heard about the stories of people who go to L.A. with a dream of becoming an actor or actress, and they wind up for years maybe waiting tables or having some other job so that that's, you know, hopefully flexible enough so that they happen to get a casting call, they can go and do it, and they just struggle to make it. And those who do make it are so rare, and you can see why they're so desperate to make it. And then you get these people who have all the power, who exert that power in just such a depraved way. And now it's finally coming out. What, you know, it's hard to say exactly how far this is going to go. You know, it's interesting. Corey Feldman, the child actor, who's now obviously, you know, well into adulthood, talked years ago about how he was molested by a guy in Hollywood. And so when he was talking about, people kind of dismissed it. In fact, Barbara Walters, very famously on the show The View, scolded him, saying, you're going to take down an entire industry. So it was all on him. Now, I don't know how far that's going to go. You know, right now, the Weinstein thing seems to have some legs to it. And I think that more and more actresses seem to be coming forward with their stories. And some of them are talking about other producers and other directors in Hollywood, but they haven't necessarily named names. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens, because what happens oftentimes when they get into a show, or when they get into a film or a television show, they have to sign a non-disclosure clause, which, you know, and unfortunately, I think a lot of them believe that they could not tell about what's happened to them in terms of abuse, but in fact, they really can. They just don't know it. And so I think a lot of them are still holding back telling the names of the actual people who are the perpetrators. And it'll be interesting to see if it goes as far as going into the gay community, because that's that's obviously what was at work with Corey Feldman's case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of have a feeling that it'll get stopped before it gets that far, just because that's probably such a normal way of life in Hollywood, and you know, they wouldn't want to cast aspersions on the gay lifestyle at all, and to suggest that there's any connection between being gay and being a molester.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there it was with Corey Feldman, and he knew of others.
Yeah. All right, Ken, I want to take a break, but when I come back, why do progressives hate Walmart for low prices and its 3% profit margin? But they love high-priced Apple and its 24% profit margin. We'll discuss that when we return. It's 46 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. And as far as I know, it is still Wednesday, October 18th. So I'm just trying to get my feet on the ground. Kent, why do progressives hate Walmart? They have low prices and only 3% profit margin. But then they love Apple.
Yeah,
they have high-priced and 24% profit margin. What's with that?
Well, it obviously comes down to politics. And I think also it comes down to who the customers are. I think that progressives look at, I'm going to call them liberals, not progressives. I think liberals look at people who go to Walmart and think, okay, that's people from the center of the country. They're rural people, and it's a normal condescending kind of attitude toward people who go to Walmart. And on the other hand, you know, Apple, the people who are working at Apple are known to be liberal and have liberal values. And so think about with Walmart, you know, with that tiny profit margin, that means that 30 days out of every month, Walmart is just doing business to pay the bills, to pay people, mm-hmm. pay the wages, whatever. And they get maybe one day a month where there's a profit to be had, mm-hmm. to be divided out amongst the shareholders or whatever. Meanwhile, Apple, you know, it's after like a week, then, you know, everything's paid for, and then the rest of it's just pure profit, lots and lots of profit. And of course, their prices are very high. I mean, and you look at Walmart, they've made it very affordable for people to have stuff, really, just from all over the world. And Apple's creating this thing that's generally made here in our country, but then they have this huge profit margin and just enormous profits for themselves. The other thing that's interesting to look at that you know, you just have to wonder about the consistency of thinking on the part of people who are so supportive of Apple. Apple has a very male and white workforce, while Walmart has the most diverse of workforces. And you would think that that would be something that progressives or liberals would like, but they can't get over their dislike of Walmart. I think it's because of who the clientele is.
Mm-hmm. I'm really against Apple advertising. They make such attractive products that makes me want them.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, like, you know, I currently have a phone that's Apple, and I had to be kind of convinced to get it, and it is not better than my old Android. I don't care what anybody says. I know a lot of my students are just Apple fanatics, but I got to tell you, I would prefer not to have an Apple product. I don't like their computers, and, you know, I'm not attracted to any of their products. And like I say, the phone that I have it out of necessity, I guess, because when I went to get a new one, there was nothing else available.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of got convinced. It took a long time for the salesperson to convince me to move away from an Android too, mm-hmm. because it's got so much less capability. And it just, I don't understand people's love of Apple. It is, they have been masterful at their marketing and advertising and appealing to young people. And I know that they had give deals to schools so that they could get Apple computers. But, of course, then that's just to hook that next generation of consumers onto Apple. And so, I mean, they've been great at that. I will give them credit for being good at marketing and good at advertising. But when you look at, you know, who their supporters are in terms of, the, you know, liberal, you just have to wonder, like, what, you know, how they can – they've got to be overlooking a whole lot of things just to, the liberals do just to not have a lot of cognitive dissonance over supporting an Apple instead of Walmart.
Yeah. Kent, where are we in the discussion over gun control, especially with what happened in Las Vegas, and where are we now? And it's certainly a partisan divide, isn't it?
Well, it is. If you look back at the last election, whether you owned a gun or whether you had a gun in your household was a huge determinant of who you voted for. In households with guns, if you look state by state, the households with guns went for Trump all in except for one state, and that was Vermont, which is interesting because that's where Bernie Sanders is from. But even Bernie Sanders is pro-gun and as socialist as he is. And then if you looked at those with no guns, they were much more likely to go for Clinton with very few exceptions. I think the one exception was West Virginia. If you had no gun and you lived in West Virginia, you were still voting for Trump. So it is a real determinant. I think that after Las Vegas and these other things, I think people have finally kind of come around to the realization that more laws aren't going to stop such crimes. I mean, even U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, who has always been extremely anti-gun, has said after the Las Vegas shooting that no law could have stopped what happened there. And I think that a lot of people are coming to that realization. And in fact, a lot of people are kind of coming around to the idea that, you know, we maybe ought to be armed for personal protection. And I've been an advocate for that. And I know that there's even advocates for what's called concealed carry on campus. Now, not necessarily here at Northwestern, but that's a bit of movement at college campuses across the country because, of course, some of the mass shootings that we've seen have taken place at college campuses, and people wonder, well, if there had just been even just one student or a professor who had concealed carry permit and was carrying, if they could have stopped some of the bloodshed. And I think they probably could have, and I think a lot of people are coming to that realization. And not only that, but it could be a deterrent from somebody even trying to come onto college campus. What happens right now with a lot of – and this is the part that's really scary to me – is you see a lot of these places that put up signs saying that they are a gun-free zone, and that's the truth with most elementary and high schools is that they're gun-free zones. Well, for anybody who wants to commit a crime – that's just like a welcome mat because they know that they're not going to experience any resistance when they go in there. So if you're crazy and you think, oh, I want to shoot up as many people as possible and create as much havoc as possible, that's exactly where you want to go, is someplace where you know you're not going to have any resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've seen.
Kent, the Republican National Committee has already raised $100 million in the first 9 months of the year. And that's the first time it's raised that much that fast in a non-presidential election year. Really, it's become a flurry of small dollar donors. What do you think about that?
Well, I think Trump has motivated a lot of people that they can make a difference because, you know, back when he was running for president, most of his donations were from small donors, just like what we're seeing going to the Republican National Committee today. I think a lot of people see that, you know, we need to have a Republican Congress mm-hmm. along with a Republican president if we want to make any headway in terms of, you know, a conservative agenda, especially things like Supreme Court appointments. And people are thinking that there might be another one coming up. And we have one that Trump made already that is just everybody agrees is an excellent choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might not like his politics, but everybody agrees that the guy is brilliant. And I think that we can look forward to maybe another one. And I think people are kind of conservatives across the country are realizing like we need to have a conservative Senate for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Ken, thanks so much for coming into the studio. I know there's a sign in your classroom that says this is not a bagpipe free zone.
True. True story.
Yeah. I don't know. When are we going to get the pipes in here?
When are you going to bring them in and play? Some of these days.
I don't care. Bring it in.
Right.
Seriously. We'd love to have a little small concert. When I say small, I mean small and short.
Me standing outside with you having the windows closed.
Exactly. That'd be good. Kent, thanks so much. Have a great week. I will talk to you again next week.
Thanks for having me on.
It is, 57 minutes, 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back. Thank you to Karen Ellis and to Dr. Kent Kaiser. What a great hour we had. I hope you've enjoyed it. We've got a great second hour coming up. Just got a little note from Bill English that he's a little under the weather. He just apparently had a slice of fruitcake from Christmas 2014, and he's not feeling too good, so he's not going to be with us. Fortunately, we've got a wonderful conversation with a couple of pastors from Lebanon. How cool is that? Live from Lebanon. We'll be airing that just about 8 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break and be back with hour two. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.